Welcome to the Seattle Public Library's podcasts of author readings and library events, a series of readings, performances, lectures, and discussions. Library podcasts are brought to you by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation. To learn more about our programs and podcasts, visit our website at www.spl.org. To learn how you can help the Library Foundation support the Seattle Public Library, go to foundation.spl.org.
I'm Chris Higashi. I'm the program manager of the Washington Center for the Book at the Seattle Public Library. Welcome to this evening with Seattle poet, writer of all sorts of things, Colleen McElroy. Pleasure to welcome you here tonight, Colleen. So thank you first to Elliott Bay Book Company for co-presenting the evening. We thank the Seattle Times for generous promotional support for library programs, our author series sponsor, Gary Kunis, and finally, this event is supported by the Seattle Public Library Foundation. It is private gifts to the foundation that make possible so many of our free library programs. So to the thousands of donors to the library, including those of you here tonight, we want to say thank you very much for your support. Here's Karen Maeda Allman from Elliott Bay Book Company to introduce the rest of the program. Thanks.
So, good evening. Today we have poet, folklorist, novelist, researcher, teacher, editor, playwright, and travel writer, and also beloved teacher and friend to some of you in the audience as well, Dr. Colleen J. McElroy. She was the first African-American female promoted to full professor at University of Washington, something I learned from this book. I didn't realize that was so. She retired recently after 35 years as professor of English and creative writing at the University of Washington, and she previously served as director of speech and hearing services at Western Washington University. She was editor-in-chief of the Seattle Review from 1995 to 2006, and edited and published many a wonderful issue of that journal. She's the editor of numerous books, including 9 collections of poetry now, and among them, Sleeping with the Moon, which was a 2008 Penn Oakland National Literary Award winner. She's also the editor of a collection of travel memoirs, A Long Way from St. Louis. And this, I have to say, is one of my favorite books of the genre and has some wonderful writing about, among other things, places like Malaysia and Japan. And there are few books by people of color writing travel memoirs, and they are very beautiful and also very thoughtful essays. She's also the author of Over the Lip of the World, Among the Storytellers of Madagascar. And for this, she was a Penn USA Creative Nonfiction finalist. This was, some of you may also know that she's done considerable work recording oral histories and folklore, and she did an extensive trip to Madagascar a little over a decade ago, and this wonderful book is documents some of the work that she did. She's a recipient of many, many fellowships, including 2 Fulbrights, 2 NEA grants, Rockefeller and DuPont Visiting Scholar Fellowships. She is a creative, original voice, much rooted in the Pacific Northwest, but also one of those writers who's very engaged with people from all over the world, both through her own curiosity and collecting of stories and reading, and also because her work is translated into so many different languages. She's here today to read from her much-awaited new collection of poetry, Here I Throw Down My Heart. And this was published just a few months ago in 2012 as part of the Pitt Poetry Series at the University of Pittsburgh Press. So Colleen will read some of her poetry and make some remarks, and she invites your questions after that part of the reading. And then afterward, she'll be available to sign her books, and we have copies of the new book and also some of the previous books on our book table. Please join me in welcoming Colleen J. McElroy.
Thank you very much. Oh, there's a form I have to fill out.
There's a petition for me to record.
Okay. Can you hear me back there? I was getting feedback on the first row, and so I hope you're not getting all of that. Since this book was published, and I've given maybe half a dozen readings in Seattle, and every night that I read, it rained. So I'm going to begin with a poem that is about traveling as well as about Seattle rain, which we're beginning to have many names for. I like broom for some of the rain that comes out of the fog, you know, different names. It doesn't help the mic, is that it? Okay. It doesn't help you tolerate the rain more, but it gives it a kind of mystery. A sojourner, a traveler, occupies a kind of amorphous intermediate space posited between two strong statutes. She's neither voyager nor denizen, a tourist who repeats the desire to remain. And I have been a tourist, but as the Malagasy proverb says, I enjoy myself to the fullest and remain the perfect stranger, because it may seem like a familiar place, but it isn't really. The Sojourner's Diary. Winter is by far the oldest season, when the air thins without the rustle of leaves snapping under the footsteps of squirrels like wrapping paper left loosed under an easy chair. I borrow time by writing what I say. I say the weather is bitter, when in fact I am the one without humor, growing into loneliness like winter. I no longer question sounds echoing from a distance, the sweet flutter of a butterfly's wing near a pagoda where snow light grows dull as mold and the patterns of frost on my kitchen windows repeat and repeat as if on a kaleidoscope. Look here, the shape of a lantern, and there, a bear's paw print glazed with sunlight. I measure shadows on mirrors lodged under the eaves and watch another winter begging to be forgiven for the next day's hunger. Empty hours stretch beyond each day, and what few notes I take confuse me later. After a second glance, I know so much goes on under the snow. Lacy petals of Eisenbloom hatch from the cold, a cruel imitation of summer flowers. A lone robin steps gingerly on the crust of snow, its head tilted as if to say, "What is this weather?" I shout an answer, but the wind blows away its song. Winter is the season we promise to right whatever wrong created in the champagne of reckless summers since that first autumn when the earth cooled and told the stars, this is what winter will be. Some days I put my elbows on the sill and listen to the wind hold court with bare limbs of trees. I never believe everything I hear in the scowl and scrape of twigs and frost crackling. The faint cry of morning birds reminds me of the sun, its sudden light at dawn. 2 days ago, as I came home, there's a bramble tree right outside my window, and there were six robins in that tree, and they all looked like, "What is this? It's not supposed to be like this." I said, "Get over it." The book is really about home, the absence of home, the presence of home, how we carry home with us when we're away from home, how we create home sometimes out of nothing, though we may live in a house that has all of the comforts, this may not be for us home. We sometimes take home out of what is not there to make ourselves comfortable. And of course, there's always that longing for the home where we grew up, the home of birth, the home that positions us on the planet. I pay attention to people who are classified as homeless, and I sort of know some of their habits, some I don't, but I until about last year, I always passed an intersection where there were a group of men gathered, and they had the usual signs, but there was also something else about them, because there were great philosophers in that group, and they would regale the motorists passing by with their philosophies of the day. Juju crossings. One of these mornings, and it won't be long, you're going to look for me, and I'll be gone. One. Street dude says, ain't nothing to it. This mess about a job and security. What's social about that, I ask. And the light changes. Traffic racing to the next intersection, to the next beggar with less philosophy and more hunger. They are everywhere, interspersed between construction cranes and traffic jams. Who says we outsource everything? The crop is homegrown and speaks the indigenous language of every train that has pulled away from this town in a dead heat, help-wanted signs littering the tracks behind them. Two, when you ask your son what he wanted to be when he grew up, he did not say, I want to sleep on the street, eating restaurant slop before it cools and the rats come in, before the vermin salt the stew and sanitation picks up the last bit digestible. When you ask, he said only that he wanted not to bring a child into this world where it is cold and hungry and scary. And you laughed at his teenage fear. But he has kept his word, shown how easily anyone can slip between the cracks of what passes for civility when all you know is lost in that river befouled with good intentions. Three. Despite yourself, you look for him on every corner, behind signs reading, work for food, or hungry, please help. You look quickly, not ashamed, but not knowing where you'll turn if you see the familiar tilt of his head, the sly smile that says, don't look at me. I'm undressed out here among the suits and overcoats. I was headed somewhere else, following a route inside my head that led me down the wrong street. Don't look. I'm not ready to come back. Four. Rag pickers, the old folks call them. Hobos, bums, a solid parade, meandering down the alley, never visible to the street. Bad luck to stare at them, you were warned. When he's lucid, your son can see the horizon, laughs with you until between one day and the next, he vanishes to some place you cannot see. Some days you sit by the window as if by sheer willpower you can make him appear in the broom beneath a bridge or the underside of a freeway. No one is out there by choice, not the street dude with wisecracks ready to put some juju on you, or the old one who takes his time stumbling across the intersection, unmindful of your hurry to go, go, go anywhere away from the smell of desperation, the vague recognition of a face that is all too familiar. Ain't nothing to it, the street dude says, and laughs at no one in particular. I choose to write in different forms. I do write the standard stanzaic patterns, but I rarely rhyme religiously at the end of each line. My rhymes tend to be internal. And I also write what I call a prose poem, which means it looks like a paragraph, but if you took that paragraph apart, you would see that there are poetic lines with rhythm and with rhyme in it. but the way I placed it on the page, it looks all of one piece. And I refer to these more as soliloquies, like Sojourner's Diary is a soliloquy because it's all in that prose poem pattern. Some prose poems are letters. And then I also write what I call the slideshow. I don't know if you remember these, at least I had them when I was growing up, these books where if you flip the pages really quick, you can see the figure moving, even though nothing was moving, it was just you're flipping the pages. And some of my poems imitate that pattern. One of the things I've done is I was a writer in residence in Alaska, and I did work along the Arctic Circle. And sometimes my classes were done over two-way radio, but the kids who were at the other end really wanted to be in class. I mean, it's sort of like when you're told you can't do it, you really want to do it. I see these kids with their pants dragging, and I think, if someone told you you had to wear those pants, you wouldn't want to do it. But it was sort of that antithesis of things. Anyway, I don't like snow. It's not that I don't like rain, it's that too much of it sort of gets to me. It's irritating. But snow, I really have a fear of. And I can't say why. I don't know why. But it's deceptive because you can put your foot, especially in Alaska, you put your foot down in the snow and your foot just keeps sinking because there's a crust on top, but it's soft underneath. So I was paying a lot of attention to details while I was in Alaska. This is called Ice Golf on the Arctic Circle, and it has that, it's patterned so that if you had the book, you could flip the pages and then the figures would move. One, a canoe frozen outside the window. Two, angled light shedding battered blacktop. Three, old hunting spears from times past. Four, if your footfalls are soft, the old one will not shoot you for the fun of it. Five, 1,000 boxes of frozen honey. Six, raven squatting in an empty house. Seven, wait for the water to freeze solid before you bring out last year's golf clubs. Eight, paint the golf clubs red, else they'll be swallowed in a sea of snow. Nine, Dr. Seuss's snow machine still sits beside the weathered boards of Mamie Reich's house. 10, signs that tell yield, stop, or go, while dogs yelp at the stars. 11, old tent tarps flapping in Arctic winds. 12, at night even the wind seems lonely. 13, teaching class over the two-way radio and all the students are attentive. 14, the water in stillness breaks nature's sigh. 15, ice reaching as far as the eye can see. 16, how quickly the world disappears in the far cold reaches until spring. 17, the old one said this would last forever, now forever seems not so far. 18, getting a hole in one if the wind allows. 19, when the ice road opens, we go with our car. 20, dogs pant to the crunch of packed snow. 21, morning sky shimmers purple and pink. 22, there is so much sky you can lose a golf ball, even painted red in mid-flight. 23, your breath hangs, waiting. They actually did try to teach me to play golf on the ice, but I didn't trust the ice, so I wasn't very good at it. The second section of the book is devoted to women in the military. And I know you heard, I think it was a couple of weeks ago, that the military has finally said that women can get combat pay and get promotions based on their combat duty. It's not like women have not been in combat, but they're not classified as combat soldiers or sailors or whatever, so they don't get combat pay and they're not recognized. And then I read a couple of days later that some of the Marines said if you put women Marines in combat, they were going to leave the service. Well, you know, don't let the back door hit you. But these are poems about how women cope with that situation, how they become empowered or not in that situation. And I use a persona, which is simply she. There's no name to it. And she changes with each poem. So it might be a slightly different kind of she. But if you read all the poems together, then you get this feeling of the multiplicity of women who are in the service. This is recruited. She says, after high school, it was this or some dead-end job, so what choice did I have? Twice, recruiters chased me across the mall, caught me between cheap clothes and fast food, told me about a good life in uniform until they had me thinking how good I'd look, afro braids tucked under my cap. She says there was no place to hide. Recruiters tracked me down, strolling along like I had time to kill, and going home was the last thing on my mind. We're all family, they said, then dropped me in this detachment with dumb chicks waltzing in, acting crazy, like nobody ever sent them running because of the color of their skin. And if you want to know the truth, all of us crazy on dust and blood and how much crap we got to take before this war is over. And about the time I'm thinking black or white, one body's good as another on the front line, reporters come in to scoop the action for folks back home, and the white chicks pose for cameras, and I'm thinking this ain't family worth a damn. First blood. With the an Arabic proverb, those who have seen death are content with the fever. Claimed she wouldn't hurt a fly before she got the calling. Now she stitches the sidewalk with machine gun fire, just in case, she says, someone's waiting out there to put a hurting on me. You get used to it, she says, keeping an eye on snipers, suicide bombers, man, woman, child, one body good as another. Her eyes, the innocence of the girl next door, minus the gun she cradles like a leg of lamb she's brought home for Sunday dinner and the whole damn extended family except a chosen few who will be laid out like cordwood on the road behind her. Film noir. She says I had to prove the right to wear this uniform, show I'm not just some movie slut hamming it up for the camera. Still, at night, my fingers hurt from holding my weapon up close, and I can't remember my last manicure or how a real bath feels. But when I hit the bricks with the boys, I know nobody out here cares who's under that flak jacket or how many bullets are left in my clip. Nothing personal. Man or woman bleed the same chasing a line of ghosts somebody thought they saw a minute ago, chasing bullets whistling from shadows that turn into sand. Nothing you can put your finger on, she says. We sweep the gutters clean and hope the only sound we'll hear is the rush of blood in our ears. At night we dream the whole damn world is shutting down. What stays here? I'll let the poem speak for itself. She says, I came here believing bad things happen to other people. Came damn near believing a good soldier follows orders, and a good girl, she says, steers clear of trouble. Out here, we were told, whatever happens out here stays out here. So I hold back out of loyalty, stupidity, or a little bit of both. I learned to take stock of what moves too little or too late, how many rounds in a standard issue weapon, and who in the end calls the shots that keep us alive. When I ride home, I tell them how many blacks rotated in and how many Latinas or Chicanas or whatever they call themselves, like it's going to matter when the deal goes down and you're strung up against a fence or on the ground. Just another one out of seven nailed before her tour is over. And I don't tell them nothing is what I expected it to be and that it's not what I say that counts. How the CO's leathery voice hangs in my ears, and when I pass, he hefts the boys and laughs, points his finger like a trigger when he calls my name. I don't tell them back home how the one night I forgot I was caught barefoot looking up at the stars, and how I heard the sound of a belt hasp loosening before somebody's rough hands found me walking alone, just taking too much time leaving the latrine. And me thinking there must be some kind of blues or country western for what was dragging me down. The same line repeated again and again. Do you like it? Do you like it? Do you do? I'd scream, but nobody comes running when you scream bloody murder and there's murder all around. So I'm left with nothing to do but swallow my spit. What's done is done. Tomorrow he'll shine me on. We'll walk recon to another village. He'll look for roadside bombs. I'll look for snipers. Whatever happens, we're stuck here under strict orders. When I ride home, I'll tell them how the desert looks in the morning when flares crisscross an oil-soaked sky and the smell of sex and death fills the air. Second tour. On the first leg of the flight from home, she says, I almost missed the plane going by habit into the men's, thinking I was back in the zone where we all shared the same urinal. And the soldiers traveling in the same deployment look up in vague surprise from their buddy talk, the old routine, the joie de vivre that keeps them battlefield ready. When they look up, it is as if with one blink of the eye she might disappear, her shadow still intact, and in half a heartbeat, they turn back to their own distractions of how close the plane has come to the point of debarkation, and how long before one meal tastes like the next, and where it is safe to look at the sky, or what is there is to say when war singles out neither woman nor child. So easy to forget we don't use the same urinal in real life, she says, to no one in particular. And in the silence that follows, no one looks up from their appointed tasks. The crossword puzzles, the MP3, the paperback, and airplane noise. What is there to say when someone is tearing down the house they think should last, war or not? Sweet divisions marking his, hers, ours. What news? On Mondays when theaters are dark and the world smolders from weekend fires, what news then when news travels fast on an atomic clock of ordinal and cardinal numbers and emotions clog the brain? What news when your rotation comes through and you already have trouble with the sitter and your husband deployed months ago? What news comes without the smells, the odor of sex, of wars, without the stench of death, the salt of work untasted, the stuff that comes quickly, like childbirth in the movies, where the heroine awakens, makeup unmust? What news comes before you get the diapers on the line, before your uniforms fill your duffel bags one more time, and the family arrives to wish you well, and you kiss the baby one last time, looking over your shoulder, as the news comes in quick, more at 6 and 7, the sound bites loud enough for indigestion? What news hastily scrawled across a scrim of pretending pages, papyrus of a digital age, and you glimpse a face like yours that fits the national average of casualties lost out there where the sky and ground suck out all the light and a break in the clouds looks like the eye of God? Okay, I'm going to move away from war. Not that far, but move away from it somewhat. I travel a lot. Actually, I travel less these days than I used to. And some of my poems are about other places. And the act of traveling, really, I can't remember who it was that said, the joy of traveling is not in getting there, but in the act of going there. This is going there. We will cross where the border is porous, where deals are unmade and papers transparent. We will cross where everyone can see us without suspect or hurry. We'll make it to the other side. We'll seek a place of some safety where origins are of less concern than the craft of what we can offer. We'll pretend the guards are friendly and make our way uncertain yet sure-footed. We'll spell home for them in several languages. We'll observe all the necessary gods, the prayer wheels and beads we always carry. We'll turn into the wind and leave no scent. We'll take it all with us and hope there is room when we get there. We'll cross before darkness can hide us and no one can find us if the border disappears. When I was in Jordan, I was touring with the State Department. We were talking literature and publishing, because in other countries, the act of writing and publishing is vastly different. First of all, they don't have creative writing classes, and they keep saying, "Well, how can you turn somebody into a writer?" Well, we're not doing abracadabra. We can't turn someone into a writer. And when you get to the publishing stage, there aren't any literary agents. And on this particular trip, I was traveling with a publisher, an editor, a publisher, a bookseller, and a literary agent, and I was the writer. And when we would say literary agent, they'd get all suspicious, and I said, no, not agent provocateur, just, you know, one that looks at books, doesn't look at anything else. But one of the places we visited was an art residence in Jordan, in Amman. And they had some interesting displays, very provocative displays, because some of their artists had come from war zones. Jordan is right there next to Iraq and all the other Mideast countries. And so sometimes the artists come and are in residence in a safe place. We do have a place like that in the U.S. For people who come from other countries who are under stress because of war. And it's called the City of... No, I'm sorry. The Asylum of Hope that's in Pittsburgh. And it's beautiful. They have a four-block area that they've rebuilt and made into individual places for people to live. And the artists can come there and live for a year. And they are supplied with all the things they need to do whatever it is they do. And then in a year they have to leave. But by that time, usually someone has made connections for them so they can go somewhere else that's safe. But they're not deported, or as one of our politicians said, self-deported. But anyway, in Jordan there's this place, the Dar Alanda Gallery. It's not just a gallery, it is also a residence. The Art of War, 1. On the road between Amman and the border, trucks haul their cargo of fuel from the souks of the old city to the war. Blink, and you'd swear this scene came straight from Mad Max, the desert painted in ochre hues that even diesel smog cannot dim. 2. At Dar Alanda Gallery, the scene is stationed among artworks from neighboring wars. The artist says you need only stand in one spot for more than a minute to see these incredible patterns of pain cast upon the desert floor like so many grains of sand. Life intertwined with death, she says. I simply salvage what is there. 3. Each day the violence spreads, she says, and I take my work from what it leaves scattered on the road to create villages from vehicles that failed on a vagrant right turn or hit a straightaway of oily sand. The flotsam and jetsam turned into a montage of cylinders, spark plugs, and gas lines, families of tire shards and shell casings. 4. Lines that lead the eye to or divert it, sand houses, gear shaft temples, palm trees blackened with oil and bodies from the litter of the living and the dead. Upright or oblique, posed as if they have been just plucked from the scorched earth, as if the sky can bring them help not found at ground level. My people, she says, made from the debris of vengeance. 5. We're in the safety of Daralanda, a place where artists come from the war-torn north, south, and east. Aman lies quiet on the hills sloping above us. She says how important it is to have some way to mark destruction, how a life, no matter how small, can add to the carnage, and with distance she arranges what is left after the flames have died. 6. So many villages are gone, she says. The afternoon light sharpens silhouettes, and she tilts her head. Look, she says, you can almost see them moving with the sun. I want to read the poem that contains the title to the book, Here I Throw Down My Heart. I was in Tanzania, and the island off the coast of Tanzania is Zanzibar. And there's a trail, it's sort of like the Great Salt Road, where the captured Africans were taken to the coast. And that town is the last point on the continent of Africa that they saw before they were shipped to Zanzibar and then to other parts of the world. And the name Bagamoyo, which is a town, means here I throw down my heart. Some languages, a word is just a word, like this is glass. It does have some hidden meanings, but in other languages, there would be a word for the glass that holds water, and the whole phrase would be a single word. So Bagamoyo is here I throw down my heart. Arrivals. You are caught once again in the surreal time zone of truly alien. The crack of dawn with no familiar landmarks, yet a place all too familiar for having been there before. If not there, some place of almost empty streets. You have come to the place where the ocean begins, a place that held the last glance of Africa before captives were taken to the slave dungeons of Zanzibar. You have come to the place whose name translates to, here I throw down my heart, and you wonder if this is the place where you can begin again. You have been airborne so long, land seems strange. You think of all the hours you've gained in flying and all that you will lose upon leaving. At first, you let the wash of tires on the roadway fill in the silence. Street lights slap the darkness at regular intervals, while night people take a last breath before they too head for someplace called home. You remember the word for home in this language, if not some other. Here it is, Kwetu, spoken like the whisper of the sea on the last tide out. Someone is burning paper money for the ancestors. Someone else is collecting bottles and tin cans for the market sale. The driver makes idle conversation, but you are jet lag numb, and no map you carry will help you track where you're going, much less where you've been. Time is not so simple as having gained a day or lost one. Now you are finally down to earth, still swaying between one moment and the next, trying to get the atomic clock to tilt in your direction. You've lost count of how many cities you've seen from this angle, how many taxis or hired cars you've entrusted with your life on streets that will haunt you 100 dreams from now. You think of those Africans who passed through this place with no hope of returning, the sea a mirror that reflected only sky. The front door to the hotel beckons, and you gather yourself for the next phase, leave the car with yesterday still stuck to the seat of your pants, your head full of half-remembered phrases studied just for this trip. Thank you. I have to apologize because sometimes I had a stroke about 2 months ago, and sometimes I'm on one word and the right side of my mouth is not catching up, so it has that little hiccup in there, and I heard it a couple of times. When I say that, people say, I didn't hear anything, but I do. So do you have questions? The question was, when you talk about Jordan, I think about the Middle East and Iraq and all of those places there. Yes, and they are very close by. And you can see the supply trucks going down the road. Well, they're not our supply trucks, but the Iraqis taking fuel from Jordan. And there's a highway that goes cut straight through there. I met the king's nephew who took us to the summer palace. He wants to be a writer. Everybody wants to be a writer. But it's very interesting because it got me closer to that war zone. And you could tell we were coming upon the war zone because the sky just gets darker. And it has an undercoat of red, but then there's that gray dust that's floating in the air. I'm going to talk about Madagascar. Yeah. But this is just about Jordan. Yeah. I went to Madagascar as a Fulbright scholar, and my research was in the oral tradition. I researched folk tales and stories that had passed through generations. And I spent 3.5 months there. It was one of the best trips I've had. Well, I actually learned how to do the research, because when I graduated, you know, I had my little notebook, and I went to South America first, and I would say, okay, I'm here, and I'd like to talk to some of your female storytellers, and if you could arrange for tomorrow, have them here. I have some openings at 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock, and 11 o'clock. And these people are looking at me like, what did you sail on? But by the time I got to Madagascar, I had learned to listen instead of talking. I just became very enamored with that country. It is now suffering from the same thing that many other countries are suffering from, which is it's war-torn, and there's corruption and all of that. And they're accusing the Malagasy of cutting down the trees, but Madagascar has no industry. It doesn't have a factory that produces fuel, or it doesn't have coal fields. You can't mine for coal. And so the trees are the only thing that's there. And the French had made it impossible for people to set up affiliations there, even though the French aren't there anymore. And it's a very interesting place. It's not a place for the faint-hearted, because sometimes we would take the road out of town and the road would end. I mean, just literally end. And you have to be able to adapt quite quickly. But it's not like other countries where they've been beast, two-legged, and wormy-like, who will attack you. This is not that. But I met quite a few storytellers, and most of the stories that I collected were done in song. So the elder would get up and begin to sing, and it would be the story of the king or the story of the prince, or, you know, the typical stories. So, yeah. Yeah.
I noticed some of your poems use a double colon.
Yes. I noticed in some of your poems you use a double colon, and she wanted to know why. Basically, I hate punctuation. What is that? Oh, eats shoots and leaves. Well, of course, that was the typesetter. The typesetter just put the punctuation in the wrong place. It's the panda who eats shoots and leaves, but he put eats, comma, shoots, comma, and leaves. And it's like, what 45 was he carrying when he left? But I use space a lot for punctuation. So I'll put three spaces between a phrase, one phrase and the next. And I use a double colon when I want, it's sort of like a fence, you know, a chain link fence. So it will stop you, but if you're clever, you can get around it. But it will definitely stop you. And, I guess because I just had a lot of trouble diagramming sentences, it just drove me crazy. And I was always creating the sentence. In fact, that carried over to some of my other art when I was in Kansas, Lord help me. I had a paint-by-number set, and I was so desperate to create, I ripped all the numbers off and did my own paint. So there were strange sunsets and whatnot. And I guess I do that, too, with punctuation. I just take it out, and then I read it. And I read it several times to try to figure out what does a reader need, because that's what punctuation is like, signs on the road, exit 10 miles, you know, that kind of thing. And that's what the reader needs. The reader doesn't need to know that you are really clever in putting periods and semicolons in places. In fact, they slow down the rhythm of the poem. So, and I don't think I've ever used a semicolon in a poem. I may have. By accident, but yeah. But I use that double colon because it's a kind of rebellious thing, you know. Instead of using a period, I use a double colon. Yeah.
A hand for Colleen McElroy. Thank you.
This podcast was presented by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation and made possible by your contributions to the Seattle Public Library Foundation. Thanks for listening.